For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Dr. Jason Old here, surfer, historian, world traveler, and your host of the Surfing Historian Podcast. This season, we'll be diving deeper into the nuanced world of surfing and examining the historical, cultural, philosophical, and even scientific elements of the sport we're all stoked on. So let's paddle out together and ride through the world of academia. This episode is sponsored by Face Stuff. Face Stuff's an all-natural zinc-based product company from San Diego, California that uses ingredients that are safe for the ocean while also protecting and moisturizing your skin. So instead of soaking up nasty radiation like chemical sunscreens, Face Stuff helps your skin reflect it. I'm a big fan of Face Stuff and always have a canister on hand and ready to use. Check them out at face-stuff.com and use promo code STOKED15 for 15% off their incredible products. Joining me today is journalist and novelist Michael Scott Moore. Michael's the author of a travel book about surfing that he titled Sweetness and Blood, How Surfing Spread from Hawaii and California to the Rest of the World, with some unexpected results. A book that was in fact revered as one of the best books of 2010 by The Economist. Sweetness and Blood, by the way, is also featured on surfinghistorian.com. Shortly after the publication of this intriguing book, Michael was kidnapped in early 2012 on a reporting trip to Somalia and held hostage by pirates for 32 months. He wrote a memoir about this experience that became an international bestseller. That book's titled The Desert and the Sea, 977 Days Captive on the Somali Pirate Coast. For today's episode, we'll focus primarily on his surfing history, Sweetness and Blood. However, we'll also make time to chat about his harrowing experience as a hostage in Africa as well. I'm super stoked to have you on to share these stories with our listeners. I'm also looking forward to picking your brain about some of these surf destinations you wrote about in Sweetness and Blood, some of which I've personally surfed, others I'm interested in visiting in the near future. But before we get started, I want to personally thank you, Michael, as well as our listeners, for being part of this episode of The Surfing Historian.
Thanks for having me, Jason. This is terrific.
Hey, Michael, thanks so much. You know, no, the pleasure is mine, to be honest. I'm really grateful you've, you know, taken the time to come on. And I just want to get right into Sweetness and Blood. You know, I enjoyed the book. It's on surfinghistorian.com. And, you know, I recommend it obviously to our, to the listeners, go check it out. And I think one of the things I really liked most about it was you talk about a lot of places that are, you know, a lot of them aren't high profile surf spots. And so I just want to go ahead and get into this. And I'm just curious to know what compelled you to write this book and even what compelled you to go to some of these places.
Well, I tried to put a mix of countries on the list because I didn't want to write about all the countries that people knew about or that surfers knew about, but also some places where even surfers might be surprised to learn that there was a surf scene. And it actually started with Germany. So I don't think I would have written the book if I had not moved from California to Berlin in about 2005 or so. I started the book in 2007. And one spur for it was learning that there was a surf scene in Germany at all. And since I'm from Redondo Beach, which is where supposedly the first surfer in North America first landed in 1908, that was George Freeth from Hawaii, I thought, well, who was the first surfer in Germany? And that was a fruitful question. So that was a fertile question. And it turned out to be a really interesting answer. And from there, I had already been to Indonesia. I had lots of material from Indonesia. The surf history there turned out to be really interesting. Otherwise, that's a typical, you know, surf destination, at least for Australians. And then I made a list of other places that were both a little bit unlikely, but also had a really good origin story. So that origin story was important. And the origin story was not necessarily the real first surfer. So I tried to find both if I could, but there was always a mythical first surfer, and that was George Freeth in California. There were probably other actual Hawaiian princes who surfed in Santa Cruz before Freeth, in fact, before the 20th century. There were always sort of bifurcated stories like that in almost every country I went to. But the mission on the book was to find the first surfer mythically and then historically if possible.
That's, you know, I it's interesting you bring up Freeth and with California. And, you know, I interviewed a buddy, Patrick Moser, about his book.
Oh, yeah.
We talk a little bit about that as well, where it's, you know, everybody kind of attributes the first surfer to George Freeth. And as you said, there were some Hawaiian princes that were, I think, in a military academy or something. And they were surfing
in Northern California. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think that's, you know, super interesting the way you frame it. It's like there's the mythical first surfer and then there's the actual first surfer. And, you know, in doing my research in Nicaragua, you know, I sort of stumbled upon that as well. Like, you know, a lot of myth or a lot of stories, and then there's, you know, sort of the actual first documented surfers. So, you know, I guess that's somewhat ubiquitous around the world. And so I want to go ahead and start with Germany, actually, because you said that's really what inspired you to write about this, or your time in Berlin.
Yeah.
So who are the first mythical surfers and who are the first real surfers in Germany? Because, you know, there's really, and to my knowledge, it's really just, you know, kind of river surfing. So, you know, help me unpack some of these myths and inform the listeners on German surf culture.
Right. So that's wrong. It's not just river surfing, but that's the first thing I heard about. I was in Berlin for not very long before somebody told me, oh, well, you know, there's a river in Munich where they surf. I'm like, I've lived in Munich. How do I not know that? And so I went down there to inspect that first. And I wrote a couple of articles about that. I wrote one article for the Atlantic Monthly. And that kind of led to the book, as a matter of fact, because I learned there that the little culture of surfing on the river in Munich was not the only bit of German territory that had surfers on it. And in fact, surf history in Germany goes back a long way to the 1950s, longer than you would expect for such a strange country. And the first man to surf was almost certainly Uwe Drath. That's a good Northern name. He was a lifeguard on the island of Sylt, which is near Denmark, all the way up at the top of Germany. And in the 1950s, the lifeguards got these big rescue boards, which they were not supposed to stand up on. But Uwe Drath, being an independent-minded man, had seen pictures of Hawaiians in an encyclopedia. And he thought that was just marvelous, the idea that people could stand up in the waves. And so he tried to do it, and he did it. And I forget which year. In fact, I don't think the year was entirely clear. It was probably around 1954. But a lot of kids, there were obviously a lot of grommets around even then, who were just fascinated by this guy who could stand up in the waves up in northern Germany. And so all these 12-year-olds would go out and watch this lifeguard sort of ride his board upright. And all those grommets grew up to became to become the surf scene in Sylt. And I met them. I mean, I went up there and I talked to Uwe. He was still alive at that point, kind of a vigorous German 80-odd year old. And all the guys who were younger than him were basically the fathers of German surfing. Now, you have to say that the waves in Sylt are not very good. The wind is much better. So it blows really hard, but the waves are pretty small. And as a result, windsurfing developed a little bit more vigorously in Sylt than wave surfing. And so now when people go to Germany, they realize that there are a lot of windsurfers, and that stems directly from Sylt and the conditions on Sylt. And then, of course, the fact that Germany has lots of lakes. But you have to say, it also didn't just go to West Germany. From Sylt, it spread all the way down to East Germany as well as West Germany. So you had a windsurfing culture on both sides of the Iron Curtain.
Wow, that would be an interesting Cold War history to look at. I guess in a sense, you sort of elaborate on it a little bit, but that would be a fascinating Cold War history of, you know, windsurfing.
Well, and it was. I told the story of two guys who in the 1980s set sail from East Germany on their their sailboards, and they landed on the Danish island of Møn. They actually spent a night crossing that channel, and one of them, I think, got cut off by a Soviet freighter, so it was not an easy crossing. But they landed on the Danish island of Møn and basically defected from East Germany. They had to go back down to West Germany to claim some rights. But the first thing one of them saw when he landed in Denmark was a sign that said no windsurfing.
I think that was probably the least of his worries at that point.
No, but he arrives in the free West, right?
Exactly. That is somewhat ironic.
From East Germany, and he sees a sign that says he's not allowed to windsurf.
Wow, that's, you know, and that as you're talking, you know, I'm thinking to myself, you know, and even in the book itself, you know, you go to these unique places, and as we've already said, you know, they're not high profile. You do, of course, go to, you know, some places that are a little bit more well known, but you know, I guess my question is, you know, sort of as we move through these chapters, you know, what can historians learn from this? You know, how can we learn about, let's say, the Cold War or history through this book? Because your book really is, in my view, a surfing history as well, not just a surf travel book.
So that has to be qualified. It's a history of surfing, but it's a history of modern surfing. And the spread of modern surfing is absolutely associated with the spread of American influence and the spread and the changes during the Cold War, and that's really important to say, because of course lots of people everywhere have developed surf cultures, and that's become more clear in the last few years. The book Afro Surf has some really good examples of it, but the main trunk of modern surfing is surfing in Hawaii and Polynesia, which is important to talk about too, but and then how it arrived in America, and then how it became something new, just like the blues became something new and electric in rock and roll in America and then spread out all over the world. I think there's an actual parallel to be made between modern surfing and what became rock and roll too, because you know, America became an empire, especially after World War II. It started to do that beforehand, but after World War II, like all empires, it absorbed these cultures from other parts of the world, and then it changed them. And that's really what the book is about. And that's one meaning for the title too. The title is Sweetness and Blood, because the legacy is also bifurcated. The legacy is not entirely good, just like the legacy of American influence around the world. But it's also not entirely bad. And what a lot of people received from this notion of this notion that you could surf at all, right, was an idea of freedom, and that is something that America exported without quite realizing it. I'm not so sure Americans realize that we've had such a huge influence in spreading surfing around the world. You know, when we think of American sports, we think of baseball. And comparatively, almost no one plays baseball around the world. You know, so our official idea of ourselves is not quite what really moved around the world.
Yeah, no, and it's a great point. And, you know, the connection between surfing and rock and roll, you know, one of the next episodes is with Tim Cooley, who wrote Surfing About Music. So I'm super stoked to get him on and, you know, chat about that connection, like you said. Yeah. And another person I've had on before who's a great friend is Scott Latterman, who's written, you know, precisely about what you said, that sort of connection between the proliferation of surfing and an American empire. And absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And just to sort of a random side note, you know, I just published an article about the three most popular sports in Nicaragua, one of which being the number one sport, baseball, and that all of those places we talk about in the Caribbean basin that are popular, where baseball's essentially number one, is a direct result of American imperialism, American occupation. So, yeah, exactly. I mean, I think you're spot on. You know, one of the things you mentioned, and I'm going to try to get past Germany, even though I find, you know, everything you were saying fascinating. Uh-huh. But one of the things I found really interesting was you said that the Germans saw, I think in an encyclopedia or almanac, saw Hawaiian surfing. So it really, surfing wasn't introduced to Germany by, say, Americans.
Yeah, that's another reason it was good to have Germany on the list. I mean, it didn't just happen because I was living there, but it was interesting to include because it was an exception to the, you know, to the kind of common rule that I was finding. I don't want to be monolithic about any of my ideas, so I wanted to show an exception to. I mean, of course, when it was spreading around the world in the 50s and 60s, people were not thinking, oh, this is this new American thing. Everyone knew that it came from Hawaii, but it had become something new and accessible, especially with fiberglass boards. And Uwe Drath really developed it, you know, in his corner of Germany without thinking about American influence. I mean, he was living in actually British-occupied Germany, but after the war, but you know, the American influence was all around him, but he's an exception to the idea that the Americans brought it to so many places.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Yeah, it's you know, super fascinating. And I'm glad you brought that up because I didn't even think about that. And so, you know, another place you talk about, I'm kind of going to jump all over the place with the chapters, but another place you talk about is the UK in Cornwall, I believe. And you know, just to put kind of a shameless plug out there, we have a number of nonprofits on surfinghistorian.com that, you know, those of you who are listening and you want to not just surf, but do more than surf, you know, check that out and get involved with some of those awesome nonprofits there. But, you know, Michael, so, but as far as your chapter, what are some of the, again, this to me, the UK is not a high profile surf destination by any means, but what were some of the places you visited and in terms of the history of surfing there, how long had that been? Had it been since, you know, mid-century or was it fairly new?
Since the 1930s. I mean, it's incredible. Uwe Drath was made it. I couldn't find an absolute answer to this, but he was maybe the first surfer on the continent of Europe. I think he surfed a little bit before, Zanuck in France. But if so, it was by a year, you know, or two. But in the 1930s, there were people in Cornwall surfing on Tom Blake style surfboards. And that one of those Tom Blake style boards, you know, they were practically boats, hollow boats, is hanging on the wall of a British pub down in Newquay, or at least down in Cornwall. And I thought that was fascinating. So I went to England partly because the history there was so interesting. I would have gone to Ireland because I think the waves are better. But I decided to stick with England, partly because there was communication back then in the 30s with Duke Kahanamoku. So there was some direct influence from Duke in the east of England.
Wow. And also, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. I think that's how they wound up with a Tom Blake board. I think Duke facilitated that. And then, you know, because England was so susceptible to the hippie movement, you know, in the 1960s, surfers, I mean, Brits were interested in all kinds of things. And one of the things that happened in Cornwall was this development of a sort of hippie style surf movement. And the first British surf company was called Bilbo Surfboards. And that is no accident that it's named after Bilbo Baggins.
Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, you know, again, like we said, with, you know, the connection between surfing and rock and roll and, you know, the hippie movement, you know, is that, I learned so much from your book, you know, because when I think of that sort of the bushy blonde hair, you know, of the, you know, like the Beach Boys music, you know, I'm thinking California, Southern California specifically, right. But, you know, I never thought to think about, you know, England, but obviously there was a robust rock and roll, you know, with the Beatles and, you know, we could rattle off all sorts of names, but yeah, I never thought to connect that surfing culture there with the music as well. So yeah, it's just, you know, again, you're, you know, taking that journey with you through England. I was like, okay, that, you know, I didn't think about that, you know, again, yeah. Because these are lesser known places and you really kind of bring to light these really amazing stories.
Yeah, that was the fun part of the book. So,
I'm gonna move away from Europe now. We're gonna head to Morocco, and yeah. You know, I was super stoked when I saw that as a chapter because I've surfed Morocco, but you know, and I think in the book you called it. I don't know if it was something you called it or it's been called this, but the California of Islam.
Yes,
and you know, I can see that. But again, let's just look at how did surfing start in Morocco? And like I said, I have a number of really, really good Moroccan surf buddies now. And as you probably well know, post-publication, Morocco has become a huge surf destination.
Yeah, and I was there right when it was becoming that. So it's been a surf destination for a long time. It was also on the hippie trail. But surfing started there as a direct result, again, of American imperialism. So the two countries I went to had surfing introduced, not by American Marines, but with the help of American Marines who were stationed there because of World War II. So the Allies invaded North Africa almost as practice for D-Day in about a year before D-Day, so I think in 1943. And we wound up with a marine station at Medea Plage, which is in northern Morocco, and at Port Liotti, I think it's called. And two young Moroccan guys, an ethnic Moroccan and a young French teenager, saw a marine on a surfboard near the base. The base happened to have pretty good surf. And these two guys saw him and decided they wanted to try it too. One was Mamoun Kabour, and he was a lifeguard at the time in Morocco, and his friend Pierre Chalot. Chalot thinks it was 1957, 58, or 59. They saw a Marine walking on water, is how he phrased it, right? He thought that was wonderful. And Chalot convinced a relative of his to send him down a surfboard from Osegor in France, where they were available. And so Mamoun and Pierre Chalosse became the first surfers in Morocco. That's documentable. But then the rest of the history of surfing, modern surfing in Morocco is hippies going down there with their fiberglass boards and then leaving behind. And normally Moroccan kids are too poor to buy a surfboard, but when a hippie left a board behind, then, you know, he could start a sort of local surf culture. And that tends to be what happened there.
Yeah, it's you know, again, the way sport, or in our case, surfing, you know, which is the, you know, what we're talking about, obviously, the way it spread through militarism is fascinating. You know, Again, like I said, Scott Latterman talks about, you talk about it. You know, I had someone early on in this season, Steve Estes, a friend of mine, that we look at surfing in the South and how surf culture and, you know, the U.S. South, how it grew because of essentially people being placed, you know, in these bases around throughout the South and were surfers.
I heard that. I thought that was fascinating. And I it's true, you know, in the rest of the world, too. I think the way I phrase it in Sweetness and Blood is that in at least a few places, surfing arrived by American force of arms.
Yeah.
You know. That's for the title. I mean, Sweetness and Blood sort of expresses that, right?
No, I think the title's, you know, an incredible title. It's really what drew me to the book. I'm like, all right, let's see what this is about. And, you know, I was obviously pleased with, you know, for what it's worth. I know mm-hmm. that I mentioned in the intro that it was The Economist put it as, I think in 2010, as like a best book of the year. So, congrats on that.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
I do have a question for you though, because you know, you were mentioning this hippie trail, and I would imagine most listeners kind of can gather what that might be about, but specifically, what is the hippie trail, and, you know, where does it start? Where does it end? And, you know, because it, obviously, as you said, it was instrumental in introducing more people to surfing in a sense.
Yeah, and more importantly, it was, I mean, that era after World War II saw a lot of young people just wanting to know more about the rest of the world and feeling very tired with their own cultures. So hippies went out to learn new stuff, and they typically went to Eastern-oriented places. And so Morocco, being the California of Islam, is the westernmost frontier of Islam as a rule. It's Sufi, which means it's more open-minded. And the other country that qualifies as the California of Islam would be on the other extreme of the Muslim world, which is Indonesia, all the way in the east, also Sufi. Both places were on the hippie trail. So hippies would go to both places, as well as, of course, Iran, Afghanistan, India. I mean, India is the sort of classic destination, but all these other places, which are now closed by war or other horrors, were open to hippies in VW buses. And so they spread out, and, you know, there were a few sort of beaten paths, and Morocco was on one of them.
Yeah, you bring up a really important point about just history in general and how things change. You know, like you said, this was part of your, you know, as you called it, the hippie trail. And now, you know, they're pretty much off limits because of conflict or, you know, all sorts of reasons. And, you know, it's interesting to see how that's changed. But yeah, as you said, I mean, Morocco, in my experience as well, seem to be more, you know, for lack of a better term, more open, more mellow. I think you said Sufi, that was the word you used.
Yeah.
But where did you go specifically in Morocco? Did you, and I guess Mike, seems like an obvious question, but did you surf as well?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I went two or three times to Morocco, and yeah, absolutely, I went surfing. So first of all, you have to say it's not just Sufism and sort of an openness as opposed to a hardline Islam. It's also kief is really available in Morocco. So you can go down there and find marijuana. That drew hippies too. One of the Brits I talked to, a shaper called Chris Jones, he had remembered going to Taghazout when he was a kid. Maybe in the 70s rather than the 60s, but he was obviously an ex-hippie. And So a lot of Brits went down there. I went to Takazut first, which is a fishing village. I also went to Imsuan. I think you mentioned surfing at Imsuan. I think Ualidia too. And Essaouira, but you know, there wasn't much surfing there.
Yeah, that's a windsurfing spot for sure.
Yeah, it's a windsurfing spot. Exactly.
And you were there. You were there in 2007 and 2008. Yeah, and I mean, I was there in 2016, 2017, something mm-hmm. like that. And I mean, it's, you know, Tagasud, Agadir, that whole area is just, you know, I've seen it really grow, you know, and over the years. So it was interesting to read when, you know, reading your book, just seeing how it's turned into this, you know, well-known surf destination. I'm trying to stay within the continents the best I can with your chapters. And I know I'm bouncing around, but you know, you also went to Sao Tome and, you know, I guess another shameless plug. I had sort of learned about the surfing culture there through, as I was perusing the world to put nonprofits on surfinghistorian.com for people to find. And I found, you know, some people doing really incredible work in Sao Tome, and I was just completely unfamiliar with it. So what was, you know, what was it like to go there? And, you know, in terms of surf culture, what was, you know, give us a little bit of a rundown on your experience there.
Well, Sao Tome was fascinating because it was the site of what was supposedly, according to Sam George, who went there in 2000, who went there a few years before I did. Sam George is a surfer here in California who's written for Surfer Magazine. And, you know, I grew up knowing his byline and Surfer and stuff like that. So he did a film about going to Sao Tome in about 2007. And he thinks that he reintroduced the kids there to stand-up surfing. But what he says accurately is that they went there looking for surf and they found an existing surf culture, because kids have been bodyboarding there on pieces of their father's fishing canoes for generations, if not centuries. And that kind of local surf culture, especially centered around fishing communities, was and probably is common up and down the African coast. The interesting, he points this out too, the earliest mentions of surfing in Africa are in Ghana. One of them even predates, if it's really a description of a surf community, it's hard to say, but obviously the parents wanted the kids to learn to swim in the ocean. And so they had a hard way of training their kids. And that gets described in 1640, I think. And that's in Afro Surf. That was just sort of dug up by a scholar here in California three or four years ago.
Yeah, you're talking about Kevin Dawson's book.
Dawson, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Kevin. Yeah, he was on a few episodes back. And yeah, he is really... again, like your book and like many, many others, you know, it opened my eyes to, you know, a world I wasn't even thinking about. And yeah, he talks about, as you just said, the sort of this legacy of wave riding in places like Ghana and, you know, the western coast of Africa. And, you know, Sao Tome fits right in there, I would imagine.
It really does. And as Sam said, he's been surfing in Ghana too, and he couldn't find anyone who was surfing. But there's another really clear description of people bodyboarding exactly like they were in Sao Tome, exactly like they do in Sao Tome. And so Sam said very, you know, pointedly, the question is, why did it disappear? Where did it go? And the answer is that these things change, you know, the customs grow and disappear and that kind of thing. But he found a fishing village called Porto Alegre on the south end of the island. Sao Tome and Principe are twin islands in a single nation that belonged to a longer archipelago, not far from Nigeria, in that bight off Nigeria. And Sam went there and I think went to a smaller island where they've now built a resort, surfed there, and a bunch of kids came out to watch him. And when he came out of the water, he sort of vainly assumed that they would, you know, sort of celebrate him for doing this. And instead, they all disappeared. They ran away. And he's like, where did everybody go? And then they all came back with their body boards because they had been doing this thing for ages. And but they had not, in their lifetimes, they had not seen anyone do it on his feet. So what they had been doing for ages was that, like I said, their fathers had these massive fishing canoes made from very light wood. And when the fishing canoe broke down, you know, it just sat around. And so it was very common to hack it up and take the bottom of the hull and use it as a bodyboard. So all the kids had these 3-foot bodyboards. After Sam visited, they carved 8-foot boards and they learned to stand on them. I have one because I traded my fiberglass board for one of them. And everybody was delighted. I was delighted. The kids were delighted to have the fiberglass board. I think they had a total of 10 fiberglass boards since Sam's arrival, right? Every now and then they collect one. I've tried to ride this wooden board. While I was riding it, it was always at least 2 feet underwater. I mean, it got waterlogged and it was really hard to ride. The guy, the one surfer that Sam focused on, but the one guy who really took to surfing named Shum, who was just out of the military when I went there. He was a teenager when Sam met him, could fucking charge on that wooden board. Amazing. And so could the other kids. I mean, they could really ride it, even though it didn't float like you and I would hope.
those exchanges are, you know, the beautiful nuggets of, you know, these surfing histories that you're talking about that, you know, Sam, I talked to Sam a while back when I was writing my dissertation, and he was really helpful with some stories. You know, all of you guys have really been in your own way helpful for me as I put together my research. So yeah, you know, I'm very grateful for the scholarship out there alone. But you know, those stories are beautiful stories, and there's many of those, you know, like I said, in Central America and so, you know, but we'll get over back into Latin America shortly when I'm really interested to hear about your, you know, experience in Cuba, which is a place I've been to, you know, quite often. Mm-hmm. And so, but, you know, another place that, you know, again, I've heard about people surfing, and I've heard about, I think you even mentioned it, Surfing for Peace, in your book, if I'm not mistaken. Again, another nonprofit on our website. You know, I've heard about nonprofits using surfing for peace building. And so I knew, and I meet a lot of Israelis around the world surfing, including in Nicaragua and other places. But I was just really curious to get your, you know, again, a bit of a history of the place in terms of how surfing was introduced and, you know, what it's like to be there and surf actually in Gaza.
Yeah, Israel and Gaza were fascinating because I arrived in Israel with a surfboard, right? And one of the border officials, when you come in, they say, well, what do you want to do in Israel? What are you here for? And I said, well, I'm here to surf. And she said, well, you know, Israel doesn't have waves. We don't have surfing here. And I remember taking a taxi into Tel Aviv right after that. I mean, immediately after that conversation and seeing a giant O'Neill billboard over a tunnel in Tel Aviv. Like, what do you mean you have no surf culture here? You're just full of shit. So again, it contradicts the official line, right? And the surfing scenes, both in Tel Aviv and Gaza, have set up a friendship and a communication that completely undermines the official state of war. And in that sense, it's a peace project. And Arthur Rashkovan, who was running Surf for Peace when I was there, and maybe still does, said he doesn't see any other way. You know, he said it's been an official state of war at the top between the leaders for longer than his own lifetime. And a lot of Israelis, just like a lot of Palestinians, are sick of it. So this kind of grassroots communication is in some ways more important because it's something that people can actually do.
So. Absolutely. You know, and I think, you know, I'm a huge advocate of sports. I had a nonprofit for quite some time where we use soccer for community development projects, education, using it as the vehicle. And, you know, I was pleased to see this nonprofit, you know, however long ago it was, that surfing was being used for these, this peace building. And as you said, both, you know, the youth and many there in their own right are sick of it. And it's a beautiful thing to see, you know, a nonprofit or surfing being used in this way. And so, yeah, it was, you know, it was nice to see again, another sort of off the beaten path surf spot that you went to. And, but so how were the waves? Did you get to surf?
Terrible. So the thing about trying to surf in Gaza, I don't recommend it as a surf trip, partly because there's so many other logistical things you have to think about it besides the surf conditions, right? Before you can get to Gaza, you have to deal with the Israeli authorities. You have to find a driver to meet you on the other side. You have to get reservations at the Al Dira Hotel or wherever, but the Al Dira Hotel is the one most Westerners go to in Gaza City. It is right on the beach. Beautiful old crumbling grand hotel, right? You cannot do all that and line up all your logistics with surf conditions. So by the time I finally made it to Gaza and got over there, the surf was flat. Nevertheless, I met the Gaza Surf Club, which was then an association of about 40 guys. But shortly after that, and I missed the story, shortly after that, they were starting to teach their sisters to surf. They would go out in full abaya. So they would, you know, they had to be young enough, first of all. Once they became women, they were not really allowed to swim anymore. But 12-year-olds could go out, 10-year-olds, and they would get taught to surf by these guys in the Gaza Surf Club. Unfortunately, I didn't see that, but I met these Gazans who all had different political affiliations, by the way. Not all of them were friendly to Hamas, which is the terrorist organization, quite frankly, that's in charge of the Gaza Strip. Some of them were Fatah-oriented and whatever, but they were all friends. And they were glad to, I think I snuck in some wetsuits on behalf of the surfers in Tel Aviv, and they were glad to get those. They had between, you know, among about 40 members, they had about 10 surfboards between them. Among them, and those surfboards were hard to find because, you know, what does Hamas want with allowing surfboard manufacture, and that kind of thing is simply impossible in Gaza. So it was all about the donations from the surfers in Tel Aviv, and that was established only in 2007 with Dorian Paskowitz, who is the pioneer of surfing in Israel. As a young man, Paskowitz went to Israel in the 50s, and he was this sort of gung-ho young doctor who was also had also been a surfer in California. And once he became kind of patriotic about Israel, he went to Israel shortly after its founding, I think during the Suez Crisis. And he was so patriotic on behalf of Israel, you have to phrase it that way, that he tried to sign up to fight. And the guy said, "What do you mean you want to fight for Israel? Do you have an Israeli passport?" He said, "No, I have an American passport." He said, "You cannot fight for Israel just because you're an American Jew." And he sent him packing. And Paskowitz said, "I felt so bad, you know, and I took my surfboard." Of course, he had traveled with a surfboard. He said he dragged it out onto the beach in Tel Aviv and he went surfing for the first time.
Wow, that's interesting. And you know, again, I just, you know, I when I think about how sports, you know, by the way, that's an interesting story. You know, he's trying to join, you know, the cause, and they're like, "Well, you know, you're an American Jew, so like you can't do this." You know, but you know, back to your point about women surfing and all of these people coming from different ideologies and places, you know, surfing levels the playing field. Surfing, and again, I would say that about soccer too. And you know, we could use probably a whole host of other sports, but that's the beautiful thing about sport when it's used beyond, I always say, like beyond the waves, like not just for exercise, but you know, for advocacy, for peace building. And you know, you witnessed it firsthand, and that's, you know, another thing that I really enjoyed about that specific chapter. And you know, the other thing about women is you're seeing nonprofits around the world, including, you know, some friends in Nicaragua that are using surfing as a way to empower young girls, young women. And so, you know, again, what an incredible experience. And, you know, you go to Japan as well, and you go to Cuba.
Let me continue the story in Israel.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
So Paskowitz, who first of all sort of seeded surfing in Israel then in the 1950s, because all the lifeguards who saw him go out and stand up on a surfboard decided to start surfing, and they became the godfathers of surfing in Israel. You know, I met their children and grandchildren in the water when I was there. But Paskowitz then in old age saw an article that showed two of the members of the Gaza Surf Club, future members, sharing one board, because there was only one board in the Gaza Strip, one fiberglass board. And he said, you know what, we should go over there and give them some boards. So without any plan about how to do it, he showed up at the Erez crossing between Israel and the Gaza Strip with like a dozen surfboards. And he made a big show, because he called a bunch of media, and he made a big show of ducking under the gate, the traffic gate on the Erez crossing, with a couple of surfboards. And eventually those got moved over to Gaza as a donation. And that was a really radical thing to do. And that was the beginning of the Gaza Surf Club, because then all of a sudden they had a bunch of boards. So this man who was willing to fight for Israel, you know, this man who was basically a Zionist, as far as Israel was concerned, was also quite willing to perform this gesture of peace towards the Palestinians. And that was important, and that was the beginning of Surfing for Peace. And he gave me an interesting quotation. He said, you know, we can, both of us, the Israelis and the Palestinians, can be very passionate about what we think we need and what we deserve, but we can also be friends. You know, it's not a contradiction to him.
Absolutely. No, and that's
an old-fashioned.
Yeah, but it's also, you know, as you said, it's a very radical idea, but it's also a very beautiful and really feasible, you know, in many ways. And seeing that, you know, this vision being carried out, you know, as some might see it as insignificant, but that vision being carried out through surfing, you know, really it's inspiring, you know,
I think so too.
And so, yeah, so thanks, you know, kind of finishing that story for us. And, you know, I know you, like I said, I was, you know, saying you were in Japan, and I want to go to Japan and hear a little bit about that. And then I'm really, like I said, you got to hang out in Cuba and surf, and a place that I've been to. And so I'm also curious about that, but you talk about Japan. You again, like in these other places, you meet one of the, you know, some of the first generation surfers, and you say that I'm quoting you, the flow of info was intimidating. And I don't know, I guess you were talking about the history of surfing, or what did you mean by all that?
I think so.
What info?
I don't quite remember that line. I would have used the word information, by the way. I think.
I probably shorthanded that. So you're probably right.
I seem to remember thinking that in Tokyo. So Japanese people just in general have this capacity for an enormous amount of information generally. And when you found like something that was interesting in Tokyo, I mean, interesting to tourists or interesting as a historical marker, there would be a sign and then an explanation of it in several different languages. And the level of detail was sort of unprecedented. And that overload was just the main experience in Tokyo. You know, you had ads and billboards and everything flashing from every direction and buildings all over the place and an enormous number of people on the street. And in that sense, it was overwhelming. And you felt that it was also a sort of mental overload. And I find that really fascinating. And in that sense, there's something typical about that. And the Japanese do have a way of absorbing other cultures because they get very curious about them and try to not just imitate them, but learn as much about them as they can. That's what happened with surfing, because in the 60s, there was a new generation of Japanese kids growing up, and they knew exactly what had happened in the war, you know, and it was a lot like Germany after the war. The kids didn't want anything to do with the parents because there was a fascist past and an imperial warmongering past. I mean, the war that Japan was involved in started earlier than World War II, right? They had an imperial expansionist war going on, and that's why they attacked Hawaii. Before that, they had already invaded spots in China and Indonesia, I think, happened during the war. But they broke the back of European imperialism during World War II in that region because they wanted to be the new imperial masters of those places. They didn't arrive as liberators. So that history was not very, and then plus the nuclear bombs, that was all a nightmare that the country was trying to awake from. And the kids really wanted nothing to do with that authoritarian recent past. And so when surfing arrived as a culture, not just the idea that you could ride a wave, but also surf music, you know, surf sounds is how they described it to me. All the kids on the coast of Japan were like, yeah. Because nothing like that had been seen on Earth, at least as far as they were concerned, right? The whole idea of pop modern surf culture was brand new back then. And they took to it because it was a complete break with the past. Now, the typical story in Japan is that the kids on the coast would see a marine surfing and want to do that. And I heard that over and over, and I'm sure it was true. There was bodyboarding in Japan from about 1914. They have their own board called an Itago. So they knew about riding in the surf. They had something of a surf culture. But I met a guy who I think was probably the first surfer in Japan who first saw, Taro Takahashi is a wonderful old guy, actually. And he said that he first saw surf pictures in a children's magazine in about 1959. And he said, I want to do that. And so first he set out to build his own surfboard, and that didn't work. And then finally he saw a surfboard that the son of a Marine had, like a fiberglass board from the US. And he inspected that, and then he could build a much better prototype. And he seems to have been the first Japanese guy to surf, even before the other kids who, you know, maybe got their hands on a board and saw these Marines off the coast. So, and he had the idea before he saw a Marine, you know, because he had seen a picture in a magazine. So that's a little bit parallel with Uwe Drath in Germany.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, just it's, you know, and this is why, you know, I kind of going back to the title of your book, you know, how surfing spread from Hawaii and California to the rest of the world with some unexpected results, you know, and just this, you know, because a lot of times, you know, like we were talking about earlier, you know, the diffusion and proliferation of surfing really was aided by, you know, the spread of American empire. But all of these other stories, like you said, like Germany, Japan, these individuals are seeing things in, you know, as you said, a children's magazine or an encyclopedia and saying, I want to do that. I want to walk on water. I want to stand on the water. And so, you know, it's fascinating. And now we just, you know, recently, you know, the Olympics included surfing. And yeah. I believe the first place it was in Japan.
Absolutely. It was actually in that coast that I visited. So right in the neighborhood where I met Taro Takahashi and also stayed in kind of a surf lodge run by a Brit, that local beach is where they had the Olympic contest. And I wanted to go back to cover it for a magazine, but I couldn't find a magazine that was willing to pay for that. the 2020 and 2021 were bad years for that because of COVID. Otherwise, I would have gone there as a surf correspondent. But it was, I got some interest, but it was really hard to find someone willing to send me there.
Yeah, definitely. I made travel a bit of a challenge. So, you know, and when I saw, okay, surfing's being introduced in the Olympics, I'm like, right on, you know, like it's, you know, I'm biased because I, you know, I love surfing, but I know you might not have been there then, but I can imagine now based on the history you're telling me that the Japanese, the folks that lived in that part of Japan where they were hosting it, there had to have been a, you know, a sense of pride, right? Like,
I think so.
You know, like this is our sport too. This isn't just Californians and Hawaiians and, you know, and some of the more, you know, Australians or whatever, but yeah. So, I mean, I would have never known that had, you know, you not sort of informed me.
Yeah. And I mean, in the meantime, of course, Japan has a terrific relationship with Hawaii. Lots of Japanese people like to go vacation there. And of course, lots of Japanese people grow up there. You know, it's part of the culture in Hawaii.
Absolutely.
So there's a lot more familiarity now with surfing in Japan, and they feel they have that direct relationship. It's not processed through the United States necessarily.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, they have a legitimate reason to, you know, to have that, you know, opinion.
Yeah, for sure. Now, one interesting thing I found in Japan was a surfboard either said the word Duke on it or was definitely from Duke, Ahanamoku, a redwood board, so possibly built from California wood. But anyway, the board was probably from about 1920, and it found its way to Japan as a gift in 1928, and it became a bench in the yard of a very nice hotel. And the owner of the hotel, the sort of young heir to the hotel, he gave me the history, but I said, did anyone ride the board back in the 20s? He said, maybe some guests.
I mean, Duke seemed to be everywhere. So, you know, maybe it could have been, you know.
I don't know if Duke personally went to Japan, but, you know, that's an earlier time when somebody very well might have surfed in Japan.
Yeah, absolutely.
To a surf.
No, it's fascinating. You know, I went to the surfing Heritage and Cultural Center. You're probably familiar with it in San Clemente.
In San Clemente, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they have, you know, I went there because I was doing, you know, my research for my dissertation, and they have, I found it funny that I was doing quote unquote archival research by digging through surfing magazines, but, you know, that's what we do. But they had all these boards from Duke, and, you know, I just, it was really one of the first times I'd been in a room with, yeah, all of those old boards together. So I can, you know, yeah. And but I can see how that could be converted into a bench too, you know, oddly enough. But yeah. So I want to sort of bring this book to a close, talking a little bit about your experience in Cuba. And, you know, that one for me, you know, because Cuba is one of the areas that, you know, I know as a historian really well, what I liked about it was you gave a bit of a history there too, you know? And I'm not saying you didn't do that in the other ones, cause you certainly did, but, you know, as I was reading it, I was like, yeah, okay. He's really weaving some history into this. And, you know, how do you talk about Cuba and not do that? But as far as surfing and just your experience in Cuba, what was it like for the listeners who were like, there's waves in Cuba?
Yeah, no, it was really wonderful. I mean, there's a surf club in Cuba, just like there was a surf club in Gaza. And the conditions were similar too, because the Cuban economy doesn't allow people to just, you know, set up a shaping shop. The planned economy doesn't even make room for the materials you would need for a shaping shop. So the first problem that Cuban kids had when they first learned that there was such a thing as surfing, modern surfing, they had to build their own boards. And those, just like the, you know, attempts in Japan and the attempts in Gaza, which there were some before, you know, the events we mentioned in Gaza, those first boards were pieces of crap. And so finally, the local kids who wanted to go out and surf realized that they needed boating materials. You know, they looked at a piece of a surfboard, maybe a broken surfboard that a tourist had brought from Europe. And then they learned to raid old fridges and boating shops, harbors, for fiberglass as well as foam. And I stayed with a guy named Eduardo Valdez, who ran the Havana Surf Club. And in his basement or his garage, he basically had a shaping shop, and he was a scavenger. You know, he took pieces of things that people brought him from abroad, including skegs and foam, and he repaired boards and he made new ones. And that's how those guys surfed. Otherwise, they did have a bit of an underground connection. You know, from Florida, Cubans know how to get stuff on the black market. And they could get leashes and things like that from Florida, but not, you know, a surfboard is a little big to smuggle. So that's how they had to make do. And I think surfing started as a direct result of two movies. One of them was Point Break, which looked anti-capitalist enough to the Fidel regime at the time that they put it on TV. And all the kids were like, yeah.
Wow. And I didn't. So interesting. Yeah.
The other movie was Maneuver Radical from Brazil.
Okay. Okay.
Those two films in about 1990 had a huge influence on the Cuban youth. And, you know, we have to realize that Cuba is only shut off from America. It's not shut off from the rest of the world. And in the 90s, there were lots of tourists coming from Europe with surfboards because. And so they would see these tourists, and they had been told by the government that Cuba was the best thing on earth and was the most advanced society, and they see rich Europeans coming with surfboards, and they see them riding in the waves, and the first thing those Cuban kids did was take their desks from school, their desktops, and took them out to ride on their bellies, and then they learned to stand from there. So that's a reversal, by the way, of what happened in Hawaii. When the missionaries went to Hawaii, they squelched surfing. They said, okay, no, we can't do this anymore. And they took surfboards and they turned them into writing desks.
Yeah, it's, you know, the whole Cuba, you know, there's a, first of all, you know, before I forget, I want to mention, there was a really good documentary a friend sent to me a little while back, Havana Libre, which was about, have you seen it?
If I saw it, it was a long time ago. Yeah.
Yeah. It was. So it's about, you know, essentially like more or less what you were talking about, this history of surfing there and how, you know, obviously building a craft that can float on water, you know, was problematic because of just, you know, people, at the time wanting to flee Cuba. And, you know, so right. they struggled to make it, you know, for the government to acknowledge it as a sport.
Right.
And
right.
So really great documentary and kind of falls in line with a lot of the things you're talking about. Did you, we've been talking about surfing there, but did you surf there? Because I'm pretty sure, I know Havana, I've been mm-hmm. to, you know, travel the whole country, and there's a couple places in the Far East, some river yeah. mouths that I think show yeah. potential. But did you surf anywhere when you were there?
Yeah, I surfed with the Havana Surf Club around Havana at those spots, and actually the waves were pretty good. But those Havana spots lie in the shadow of the Indies, so those islands block a lot of really good swells from the Atlantic. But Cuba Oriental absolutely gets better waves, I think. I wanted to go out there, but time ran short, and the best way to get out there was a plane. And I talked to Eduardo about it, and I said, well, you know, can I get there and back in time? He said, well, maybe, but, you know, the plane might break down. And I said something about taking a plane out and then another plane back. He said, no, it's the same plane. So he said, yeah, if you're worried about making your main flight out of Cuba, then don't take the flight over into the east. And that was a great. I was very sorry to miss that. And I want to go back actually and surf in the East.
Yeah. When I went to, you know, Eastern Cuba. I went by bus. I kind of just traveled, made my way across. I wasn't going to surf. I was just curious to, you know, explore the whole country, get, you know, a bit of a deeper under. I'd been studying it for a while, but as you very well know, there's a world of difference between reading and studying and experiencing. And when you compare those, it's a beautiful thing, obviously. But, you know, I was like, I'm going to Cuba. I'm going to cruise around and figure it out. But yeah, as I was on the east side, specifically the Jumuri River, I was like, this place has got surf potential for sure. And so.
Isn't there footage of waves over in the east in the film you mentioned?
They might be. They very well may be.
I saw that footage somewhere. I mean, it looks terrific. So.
And you might be right, because I think when I saw it, I was like, I knew that place had good waves. And so it's definitely got some potential. But and you know, I have, being that I'm here in Florida, it's really easy to go to Cuba. And you know, what were you saying?
You've had direct flights now?
Yeah, we've had, you know, there's been direct flights for a while, but major U.S. airlines do direct flights. We, you know, here in Tampa, Florida, we had Southwest Airlines going direct. But I've had a number of friends ask about it, like, hey, how are the waves in Cuba? I'm like, well, I mean, you know, we'd be better off going to a more consistent place, but you know, going to Cuba to surf would be, you know, and connecting with the surf club there, because you know, I have a buddy who's part of that as well. I think it'd be an awesome trip, and particularly for friends who've never been to Cuba to just experience it. But Cuba itself. So, you know, Michael, you know, I first of all love the book, recommend the book. But I would like to, you know, you've written another book more recently about a much more harrowing experience, let's say. Would you mind sharing a little bit about that for the listeners, maybe as a, I don't know, a teaser? So, you know, another book I'd recommend for sure. But would you mind just sharing about that?
Yeah, that obviously consumed my life after a while. But I was still based in Berlin when Sweet and Some Blood came out. And at the time, maybe a year later, I was covering a trial of 10 Somali pirates in Hamburg for Spiegel. And I covered it for a year. And then I decided to go to Somalia because I wanted background on the story. I thought it might make a good book. And I found some, not just a more experienced journalist who could guide me there, but also a Somali elder in Berlin who had brought European journalists down there and back safely. So Ashwin was an Indian-born documentary maker in Germany. Ashwin and I decided to go down there with him, and I got kidnapped. So I was held hostage for 2 years and 8 months, and my book about it, The Desert and the Sea, is probably my most famous book. Unfortunately, so, you know, it's about the most miserable time of my life, but I'm just happy to be alive at this point. A trial of two pirates in that case just ended in New York in February. So two pirates have been found guilty. When they're sentenced in the fall, I will write about that too.
Yeah, you know, it's what I mean, I can't even imagine that experience. You know, that is certainly for another podcast. You know, I became familiar with your surf work, you know, surf history work. But as I was, you know, reading and learning more about what you were up to, I read about that and I was like, wow, you know, I don't even know if harrowing experience is the right word. You know, again, for those of you who are listening, you know, this is the book Desert and the Sea, 977 days captive on the Somali pirate coast. So, you know, that's not on the surfinghistorian.com because it's not a surf book. But, you know, Michael, I want to recommend that book as well. It has been an absolute pleasure. I was looking forward to having you on and, you know, just really grateful we could walk through this surfing book. And of course, you know, share your experience in Somalia. But, you know, with that, I want to go ahead and give you the last word.
Yeah, absolutely. No, thank you, Jason. I think it's interesting. Maybe this is a departure from what we were saying, but I think it's interesting that we keep learning, just like Kevin Dawson brought to light, about more and more cultures around the world that obviously did some kind of surfing. They had some kind of surf culture, but and it's an important point that all those discoveries make, that white people did not bring surfing to the rest of the world. You know, these cultures have existed probably for hundreds of years, if not thousands. And so I hope that people don't get that from my book just because I focus on the spread of modern surfing. But it's also really important to note that surfing developed to a fine pitch in Hawaii in a way that's unique in the world. You don't want to take that away from the Hawaiians. And also you don't want to take away that question about why, because, you know, the going theory is that it was a Tahitian society that settled Hawaii. They paddled over on canoes, right, navigating by stars. And if those were Tahitians that settled Hawaii, why didn't they learn to surf in Tahiti, right? There's something special about that place. And that's an open question that I don't think surf research has really answered. Why did it develop to such a fine pitch to something that was done for fun and for contests in Hawaii only, as far as we know? I hope we learn more, and I hope that theory gets upended. But so far, it's an actual mystery at the heart of the history of surfing that I think is really important to consider and to respect.
If you enjoyed my conversation with Michael about his research on surf travel, I'd like to invite you to check out my next episode, where I'll be joined by ethnomusicologist and UC Santa Barbara professor Dr. Tim Cooley. Tim and I will be chatting about his book, Surfing About Music. Not only is this book an enjoyable read, it's the first major examination of the interrelationships between music and surfing. If exploring the different ways that surfers combine surfing with making and listening to music gets you stoked, then this will certainly be an episode you won't want to miss. We also want to take a moment to thank Face Stuff again for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget to check them out at face-stuff.com. And while you're there, use promo code STOKED15 for 15% off your purchase. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Surfing Historian. If you're stoked on these conversations, be sure to share, like, and subscribe to never miss an episode. And don't forget to check out our killer merch at surfinghistorian.com. Proceeds go to help keep this amazing podcast going strong. Until next time, stay stoked.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.